A damaged plane and 24 U.S. soldiers stuck on a Chinese island. China is calling it invasive, illegal, and arrogant. The U.S. insists China is overreacting. What might have been an unfortunate accident has become a major international incident. It's a disagreement that will replay itself over and over again in the coming months as the United States and China go head-to-head with their different worldviews. Two powers vying for the same role. One the young player on the international stage of superpowers, one the incumbent star. Who'll dominate the 21st century show and shape this new world order? The greatest tests are still to come. Taiwan, North Korea, national missile defense. But the people making the calls might not be the politicians at all. Money talks and business is calling. So, what about democracy? What about human rights? It's the end of Pariah Week here on The Connection, and we're talking about China, the country some would like to call pariah, but don't dare. Connection listeners, who's in control of U.S.-China policy? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to make the China connection. We'll shortly be joined from Beijing by Eric Ekholm, co-chief of the Beijing Bureau of the New York Times. In the studio with me is Evan Feigenbaum, executive director of the Asia-Pacific Security Initiative at the Kennedy School at Harvard University. Evan Feigenbaum, welcome.
Thank you.
5 days we're into this crisis, six in fact, because it went down, the planes collided on Sunday. Should it have got to this point? I mean, is this a mountain out of a molehill? It's just got out of control.
Well, it's an extraordinary event in U.S.-China relations because, ironically, the United States and China are more integrated and more closely tied together than at any time in their history. Thousands of Chinese students studying in the United States, thousands of Americans going to China each year, $115 billion in two-way trade last year, maybe more than that. But despite this extraordinary integration, we see the irony that one single incident that both sides, I think, eventually will agree was an accident that neither side could possibly have wanted. This one single incident has precipitated a debate about the entire foundations of the relationship. It's really quite extraordinary that it has come to this.
And how has it come to this? Who's mishandled it?
Well, I think it reflects to some degree the extraordinary politicization of the relationship on both sides. There is a very fragile and difficult political consensus that has been forged in each country over the last decade or so in support of this relationship. And there are hotheads on both sides, and there are factions on both sides. But the reality is that the United States and China have a complex and multidimensional relationship that has many, many different dimensions to it. For example, there is a political dimension that includes the diplomatic relations between our two peoples, but also human rights in areas such as that. There is an economic dimension, which, as I said, includes more than $100 billion in trade. There is a regional dimension. We want to keep the Asia-Pacific region stable so that countries of the region can prosper, and we require Chinese cooperation for that. There is a global dimension to try to counter proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and even an environmental dimension as well.
But you talk about cooperation and need China's help, but you also talked about hotheads. Are you referring specifically to the Bush administration? Because the Clinton administration said that China was a strategic ally. I think that was his term. And Bush immediately came in and put his stamp on this administration with the China policy saying, no, they are strategic rivals.
No, I'm not referring to the Bush administration. I think, in fact, that there is an establishment consensus in the United States on China policy. There are differences on key issues, but in the main, there is a consensus in this country, as there is among key political groups in China, that this relationship is very important to both sides. The reality, Judy, is that it is a fact of history that powers rise, and as China's economic strength becomes greater, it is inevitable, and I think, in fact, to be welcomed, that its political and even military strength will rise, too. But we need to remember that the example of the United States and the Soviet Union, where we were completely hostile to each other across the board, is in fact not a historical regularity. It is an anomaly. And if you look at the full sweep of many thousands of years of international history, I think you'll find that More commonly, great powers mix elements of cooperation and rivalry with each other. And as I said, that is both natural, and given that this relationship is increasingly complex and multidimensional, it is inevitable. The challenge then is to be sure that single issues do not begin to infect, or as our ambassador in Beijing said the other day, to bleed into other areas, so that, as I said, single discrete events shake the foundations of the relationship to their core.
Well, let's explore that complex relationship a bit more deeply. We're joined by Robert Capp, president of the U.S.-China Business Council. Robert Capp, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How concerned are you about the events of the last week?
To tell you the truth, I agree with virtually everything the previous speaker said. Was it Eric Eckholm? I came in without hearing his name.
It's Evan Feigenbaum here.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, basically my perspectives, and I think those of the business community, are very similar to that of what was just offered. Obviously, American business is a large factor in the overall relationship with China. We feel that economic relations with China are the core of the most positive parts of this very complex and difficult interaction. And politically, we feel that economic interests on both sides are probably the strongest arguers for the maintenance of a stable and civil relationship between these two countries. But we also know that economic engagement and economic interests, including American businesses alone, cannot hold the entire thing together if the remains of the rest of the relationship are being heavily degraded. So we watch a development like this with great concern. On the other hand, I've been using a kind of an oriental-sounding metaphor right now. In the midst of the typhoon, time stands still. The sense of urgency when one is in the middle of an emergency situation is palpable. You feel it. Minutes pass like days. We can look back, though, in many other cases and realize in retrospect that in the face of a very intense crisis, the two sides actually managed and defused a difficult situation with surprising skill. And I think it's too early to conclude. In fact, I don't think we will conclude that this episode represents the inscribing of the epitaph on the tombstone of more normal relations between the U.S. and China and the beginning of a period of limitless confrontation, a la what we went through with the Soviets after 1945. The question of hotheads is a very interesting one. I mean, if you go online and read chat rooms, which I sometimes think are a little bit like sort of electronic dumpsters, you'll be in no doubt that there are a lot of people in both countries who are prepared to say the most outrageous things about each other's countries and each other's people.
So are you, as businessmen, saying this is all political soapboxing when Bush talks about China being the main strategic rival? When you get reports coming out of China saying U.S. is the number one military enemy, it's all rhetoric.
I guess I'm saying that one has to be careful that the rhetoric not become the reality, but that in the case of something like a campaign period term like a strategic competitor, take it for what it is, recognize that he has distanced himself from the Clinton term of strategic partner, but no one ever talked about ally, incidentally, but recognize that reality in the form of this multidimensional relationship is going to be more complex than that. And absolutely, of course, there are going to be ways in which two great nations compete, but there are going to be other ways in which they work together. My sense is that professionals are going to manage this thing with adequate skill in the next few days.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, if you'd like to join the China Connection. Evan Feigenbaum, why, though, is the U.S. spying on China? China's asking that question. What are they doing cruising along the coast? Is their main security concern Taiwan?
By they, you mean China's main security concern?
I mean the U.S.'s main security.
Well, I think the United States is interested in several things. China's primary short-term strategic contingency, in which, and by short-term I don't mean a year or two, I mean over a time horizon of 10 to 20 years, in which China would be likely to employ military force, is, of course, the Taiwan issue. And the United States has certain commitments to Taiwan, and this is a story with which everyone presumably is familiar. And in that context, there is information that all military forces are interested in learning about each other. I'm not an international lawyer, but I know that...
Oh, dear, I was going to ask you, what is the legal position? I mean, are they obliged to hand back the plane and the crew?
Well, what I was going to say beyond that is that I think that there is nothing in international law that says that information gathering in international waters in and of itself is illegal. And both the Chinese side and the American side are aware that this kind of... observation and listening goes on. In fact, we've talked about it before in military-to-military communications. The real point I want to make, though, is that the reality is that because United States military forces operate in Asia and the Pacific, and because Chinese forces do as well, and because we have strategic contingencies such as Taiwan that often will bring us into contact, the problem in all these types of situations is that when military forces operate in close proximity to each other, there is always the danger that they will bump up against each other. And it shows, I think, this incident, if nothing else, that communication in the form of military-to-military contact, agreements on prevention of dangerous military activities, some ability to set rules of the road as military forces.
They have got a forum set up for exactly this sort of thing, I think, after an incident, I think it was in 1994, wasn't it?
Well, this came out, our current ambassador in Beijing previously was a commander-in-chief of U.S. forces in the Pacific. He was the commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, Admiral Preer. Back in the mid-1990s, Admiral Preer complained that about precisely this sort of an event, that as U.S. and Chinese forces came up against each other, he had no channels of communication through which to talk to his Chinese counterparts. We have a variety of agreements, military-to-military exchanges. We have a military-maritime consultative agreement. We've had discussions of preventing dangerous military activities. But this shows that in spite of those agreements, just how fragile the institutions are. And so I agree with everything that Bob Capp said, but I want to stress that I think that the institutional channels have been shown to be weak. The Chinese crisis management system is extremely weak. The communication links have not shown themselves to be optimal.
But Robert Capp, what role does the business community play in something like this? Shouldn't you have business-to-business contacts that would help sort this thing out, you know, with your businessmen on both sides putting pressure in Beijing, putting pressure in Washington?
You know, actually, I love putting pressure, but in this case, I think the answer is no. This is an issue that has to be worked out quickly by diplomats who are paid to do their job in exactly this kind of a situation, and in this case, with the participation as necessary of the two militaries. You know, let me give you what we do need to do is to talk quietly to our friends in both governments, find out how they're seeing things, and offer our concerns. And certainly try very, very hard to prevent the metastasis of this problem throughout the system of U.S.-China relations. And what that means, of course, is the prevention of a kind of a downward spiral of accusations and even punitive measures taken by one side and then the other, which would be very difficult to dig out from. I mean, I think actually, with all due respect to the many members of Congress with whom I have such a useful and respectful contact, that it is a godsend that the Congress is going to be on recess for 2 weeks, because once the tidal wave of media and Congress frenzy about an issue like this becomes unmanageable, then the implications for long-term damage to relations with a nation that we must have a civil relationship with.
Right. Keep it cool on Capitol Hill. Robert Capp, thanks. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the China Connection. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11, for most of the last two millennia, marriage has meant a contract binding a man and woman together for life.
Dad handled the Tiananmen catastrophe and kept relations with Beijing on course. Is W letting a little local difficulty over a spy plane unravel decades of bridge building? The number to ring, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are Evan Feigenbaum, Executive Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Initiative at the Kennedy School at Harvard University, and Robert Capp, President of the U.S.-China Business Council. What I want to explore with you both gentlemen is why China is perceived as this great rising superpower, the only challenger to the United States. Is it just numbers, Evan Feigenbaum? They have 1.2 billion people.
Well, that's one of the many elements that goes into Chinese power, but of course they've always had a large population. No, I think it's that, you know, China has had extraordinary economic growth over an extraordinarily short period. It's really, I think, the last two decades, perhaps one of, if not the most remarkable stories in modern economic history. At the same time, it is inevitable that China, which was politically and within the region marginalized for quite a long time, has sought to claim a place at the table in regional politics in the Asia-Pacific region. And so, inevitably, as its economic strength has grown, its political influence and its desire to have greater political influence and a seat at the table in the region has grown.
Is America slightly scared of China? I mean, if you look at what characterizes China, human rights abuses, jailing dissidents, it is a communist regime. You could say the same about Cuba, but Cuba is an international pariah. It's an outcast in United States' eyes. Is America afraid of China?
Well, first, I mean, there's a distinction between those cases. The Cuban government has not done economically by its people the things that the Chinese government has been able to do. It's an extraordinary story of raising living standards and raising the wealth of the Chinese people. This is in no way this in no way vitiates the realities of the harshness of Chinese political rule.
And also, America doesn't like countries surely just because they do well by their people. And you could argue that there are an awful lot of people in rural China who are desperately, desperately poor.
No, I don't. I think what concerns me most is that while we do mix, as Bob Kapp and I were saying before, elements of rivalry and cooperation in the relationship, there are things that I think ought to be flags that concern us. First, obviously, our aversion to the political system in China, but also on a more strategic level, there is, as you said, the issue of Taiwan, the possibility that our forces could come into conflict. But I think what concerns me most over a longer term is that partly as an inadvertent consequence of its concern with the Taiwan issue, China increasingly, I think, or at least elements in the Chinese foreign policy establishment, see the big questions of international politics. How should the system be organized? What is the role of alliances? When should military force be used? There are elites in the Chinese foreign policy and defense establishment who increasingly see these issues in a very different way from the American establishment. They have a view of political sovereignty that I think many American foreign policy specialists view as antique, that calls for almost no cases of international intervention, including in humanitarian situations. We have views of the world that increasingly are diverging, and then with the Bush administration's commitment to a defense-oriented military strategy on strategic weapons, we have differences in that area too.
Robert Kapp, I can hear you itching to come in there. Robert Kapp, president of the U.S.-China Business Council. What I want to ask you is how important economically is China? Because the trade imbalance is huge, isn't it? And that there is this huge potential market. But Chinese people, most of them are poor and they don't buy very much at the moment. Are you just thinking of the long term?
Well, I think the long term does matter to American companies. They see China as a as Evan has said, as an economy which is in rapid transformation in the directions we like to see, toward a market, much more market-based system. They see consumer levels and personal living standards rising. And in fact, given a very large population, they see that even a modest chunk of that population that reaches a living standard comparable to middle-income countries around the world has disposable income and has an ability to raise its tastes, which is very appealing to American manufacturers, American companies. But yes, there's certainly a combination of the now and the future in this. American companies are not, I think, as foolish as they're sometimes portrayed to be, that is, betting entirely on the future, even at the cost of losing money year after year. Many American companies are doing fine in China. But it is also a place which must be considered strategically as larger and smaller American companies look at their global plans. To just say, well, you know, China's a poor country and they have a long way to go and therefore will concentrate elsewhere would be foolish. On the other hand, if the relationship between the two countries totters, if conditions in China became unstable, American companies would say, well, there's always India to look at and Brazil, and they do that all the time. So there is a great deal going on with China now, a lot of investment there and a lot more to be done. But it is not an uncritical view that 2 billion armpits, you know, and 1 billion aspirin tablets are going to be sold next year.
Robert Capp, thank you. 2 million armpits. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mark joins us from Burlington, Vermont. Mark, hello.
Hi, how are you?
What's your point
Great
today?
Show. I'm a small manufacturer. I'm actually a crafter. And, you know, I think that we have to ask ourselves, at what cost do we engage with China economically? I think it doesn't surprise me that the business community benefits enormously from their incredibly low wage. But what about the trillions of dollars that we send over there that don't come back? In the past, manufacturers in this country would make things, and of course they'd get paid. They'd spend that money at home. And, you know, I really don't see the manufacturers in this country looking to China in the future.
Mark, can I ask you, you say you're a small crafter. Does that mean that you would be very, very worried if there were totally free trade with China, that you'd be maybe put out of business?
I am being put out, and every person who makes things by hand in this country is being put out of business by China. My best ideas get knocked off by Chinese manufacturers. That's just the way it is. But what I'm saying is, you know, and we've all mostly disappeared. I mean, I'm sort of an anomaly at this point. But, you know, what I'm saying is, it doesn't surprise me that the people in the chat rooms may be saying, sort of be slightly more negative, because what do most of the people, not the corporations, the people of this country stand to benefit from trade with China? Really, we've lost so much of our manufacturing base and our jobs. If you look around in your room right now, all you will see is products made in China. And what are the long-term consequences of basically exporting so much of our wealth?
Thanks, Mark. Let's put that to Robert Capp. Robert Capp, the accusation, it's really a bad deal for America.
Yeah, Mark, I hear what you're saying, and I've heard it before, and in many ways I'm sympathetic to the situation that you or others find themselves in. But I think that China is a subset of something much larger here, and that is that the world consists of many countries of different income levels and many countries of increasing abilities to do what once upon a time the Americans could only do uniquely in the world. And that is not, I mean, it may be regrettable that we are no longer the sole nation able to produce things for the rest of the world to buy, but that, as you say, is a reality. On the question of being put out of business by China, I think it's worth remembering that to the extent that American companies invest in China, it is usually not for low labor per se. I mean, as everybody says, if you want low labor, go to Haiti. The reason that people invest in China, in many cases, has to do with the ability to move products and move products, a good example, into the Chinese market itself. That's certainly the case with a wide range of companies, from the sort of Motorola's to the Procter & Gamble's and so forth and so on. And the other question that should be asked, and it's not an easy answer, Mark, is what are the costs of not engaging economically with China? Take the WTO, for example. If, thankfully, the Congress didn't do this, but if the Congress had said last year, when China gets into the WTO and subscribes to the rules and regulations that all WTO members must behave by, to keep order in the world trading system, we're not going to treat China as a WTO member, and therefore we will forego China's treating us as a WTO member, we would have been worse off. And I think, you know, that we can't, there are Americans who would like to see China revert to a more familiar role. I mean, the last time that China was at a pinnacle of its power was in 1790, in the middle of the Qing Dynasty. The whole history of the United States has known China in decline, dynastic decline, imperial decline, foreign invasion, civil war, so forth, and political chaos under the communists until 1979. And there are Americans who see China, a lot of us really don't quite know what to do with a China that isn't in any of those kind of disheveled roles.
Well,
there are some who would like to see China put back into those roles, and who would even argue that we ought to deconstruct the Chinese government if we can in order to do it.
Well,
it's just no way to go.
Mark, I hope that answers your question. I'm sure it hasn't satisfied you. We've heard lots of small businessmen around the world who are aggrieved at China coming into the global economy. But we're going to Beijing now. You may have wondered what happened. We had a bit of a problem making a connection. We're joined now by Bob Marcan, Beijing Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor. Bob Marcan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Bob, tell me how this crash, this whole incident, is being viewed there in China itself. Is it being seen as the first test of the new Bush administration?
Well, Well, that isn't the kind of language that they use here in Beijing. I mean, no one is kind of describing what this means in terms of Sino-U.S. relations. That isn't the way stories get played here. It's still a controlled society. People haven't heard a lot of the details about the crash itself. They didn't hear, for example, that the U.S. had offered to help rescue the downed pilot. The early expressions of remorse by the ambassador were not at first reported. Later, they have. Now there has been a lot of detailed reporting, but it's not really seen as a test of the Bush administration. I wouldn't say that's not how they are conceiving it. There's been a lot of controlled irritation and a sort of slightly rising tide of bitterness and anger among some people. There's been a lot in the media the last few days about the pilot who it looks as if the Chinese are suggesting that he won't be found now, and the Chinese are very upset that the United States, particularly the foreign press, was asking a lot of questions about the 24 crew members and not asking very many questions about the fate of the pilot.
And now are they cooling things? Now are they cooling things, Bob? Because we've got reports that there is a second. Meeting today, isn't there?
Well, I just was down on the phone to Hainan, and they've just finished the second meeting, which took place today, this evening. It just ended about an hour ago. The military attaché from the United States said that the crew was in very good spirits and looking forward to coming home, as they put it. And it looks as if it's 9/10 confirmed that there will be another meeting tomorrow. So obviously something has broken in this. Reports we'd heard earlier in the day was that Ambassador Pruher's channels in Beijing yesterday had been blocked up, and it looked as if the things weren't going to break today. But then after some initial turbulence, a scheduled 4 o'clock meeting that it was put off and delayed several times and took place finally later this evening here, it's now about 10:30 here in the evening in Beijing. The meeting has taken place, and it sounds like it's a good sign that there's another one tomorrow as far as release is concerned.
Is this incident and the way it's been handled particularly unusual, Bob? I mean, should it have been resolved quite quickly, but somebody mishandled it? Does China feel it's been offended? Does it feel this is one mistake too many after the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the Kosovo War 2 years ago?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you can speculate, until the cows come home on this. They seized the initiative partly in the way this has played out by taking a very, very absolute position right off the bat on the accident took place at 9:07 on Sunday morning, and that evening they declared the kind of absolute speaking ex cathedra about the truth of this thing, which was, in their view, that the United States was completely at fault and had to apologize and had to explain. You know, they took this very, very absolute position, which has made it very difficult for the United States to handle. Now, the fact that the President Bush came out right away and asked for a prompt reply or a prompt release of the crew, that did not help at all. I mean, a number of people, including former Clinton administration number one on Asia, Kenneth Lieberthal, who we wrote a story about this week, he's in Beijing right now, and his assessment was that, and I think it was a fair assessment, Sinologists might agree, that you don't immediately, you don't escalate to the presidential level to ask for a response, because that forces Jiang Zemin to then respond, and it gets into a tit-for-tat.
Bob Martin,
so there might have been,
Bob Markham from Beijing. Sorry to break in there. Bob Markham of the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you for joining us. But I'd like to put that point to Evan Feigenbaum, Executive Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Initiative at Harvard University. Evan Feigenbaum, is there a problem here, a culture clash, that George W. Bush is inexperienced on the world stage? And he goes to China, he says, I want my crew back, I want the plane back right away, and that's just not the way you do business with China.
I don't know if I would call it a culture clash. I mean, I agree with what was just said, that perhaps lines were drawn in the sand too early on both sides in a way that's made it much more difficult for both sides to back down. I think that's been particularly true on the Chinese side. But if I can, I've been itching to go back to a point that Mark made, because I think it's very important. He asked the question, at what cost do we engage with China? And it was a question that was framed largely in economic terms, and which Bob Kapp answered in economic terms by saying, well, at what cost do we not engage? I'd like to ask the same question that Bob did, at what cost do we not engage, but answer it also in strategic terms, because I think it's important to question a premise that's too often stated in the United States, which is that the American interest in China is solely about economics. In fact, we have enormous strategic interests in the way in which China's emergence onto the global stage is managed, because the stability of the Asia-Pacific region and the stability, indeed, of the entire international system is very much at stake, in the sense that a China whose transition to becoming a large power is not does not proceed smoothly and is not managed well.
Indeed. What I want to get, though, is China the big problem in the Asia-Pacific region, or should it be the big ally?
It's not, excuse me, can I hop in, Evan?
Yeah, sure.
It's really not so simple, Judy. I mean, the fact is that we have a huge relationship with Japan, as everybody knows. And this administration came into power with the view that the Clintons had gone too far in the direction of thinking about China first and leaving Japan in the shadows.
Robert Kapp, you should have identified yourself president of the U.S.-China Business Council. Sorry,
my apologies,
carry on.
Listeners. And therefore, that they had to sort of right the balance by paying more attention to Japan. And we'll see how that plays out. We'll see whether Japan is, in fact, willing to be drawn into a role of much greater prominence and greater activism at the Americans' behest than they have been willing to do in the past. But it's not a question of, you know, is China the big problem or should China be the big ally? This is a very complex region in which not only are there large, powerful countries, China and Japan the biggest of the two, but countries in which internal politics are very conflicted as well, certainly in the Chinese case.
We'll continue the conversation after the break. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My thanks to Bob Markham, Beijing Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor. We're talking China this hour with the U.S.-China relations. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, some think the contract between man and woman, binding them economically...
China connection. 2 years ago, the U.S. made one huge mistake in relations with Beijing, bombing the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the Kosovo War. By comparison, one U.S. plane on Hainan is a small problem, but the first giant test for Bush's most important, if most difficult, bilateral relationship. Seoul superpower to rising superpower, is he blowing it? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guest today are Evan Feigenbaum of the Kennedy School at Harvard University and Robert Kapp, president of the U.S.-China Business Council. But let's hear first from you. Steve joins us. Steve, I gather you've done some business with China.
Yeah, I mean, rather than a strategic sort of global political perspective, I mean, I've been doing business there since the late 80s as senior executive in a couple of companies. I think Bob was right talking about, quote, inside China, you know, the P&Gs and the Motorolas, because that's what we've encountered in the software business, consumer electronics businesses, is the very complex structural barriers to anything in terms of profit or recovering cash flow or whatever coming out of the country.
So is it worth it, actually, Steve? We've heard this a lot, that there's so much red tape, so many obstacles to doing business in China.
Nobody recovers profits or recovers cash flows, positive cash flows. I only had worked from Shanghai south down into Guangdong, Shenzhen, and so on, but had a wider distribution pattern. I have good relationship. People, you know, I'm listening to your other Dr. Seigenbaum and others there talking about strategic issues of an emerging superpower. You know, from a business point of view, it's a couple of generations away from that level. Of course, strategic thinking implies long term, but we seem to be forgetting that it is a, you know, a totalitarian communist system. There is declared polarity with the United States. That's not going to go away this century. So I take exception to people thinking supposedly in strategic terms, not dealing with the realities of the social political perspective.
But we've cataloged the human rights situation and the communist regime, but you talk about a couple of generations away from having any sort of parity. Do you think then that the U.S. and the world at large is overplaying this idea of China as the emerging economic superpower?
Yeah, I certainly do. I mean, just from doing business there for the last 12, 13 years and having good contacts in Shanghai and good contacts in the party, and still having investments there, I think it's way overplayed. I think one should look at the lead article in The Economist this week is pretty good. You know, what could they possibly be thinking about the Chinese leaders making?
Okay, Steve, we don't want to advertise the opposition.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks very much for joining us. Let's try and get some more calls in here. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ed joins us. Hello, Ed. Hello, Ed. What's your point?
Well, I'm just calling because I'm just concerned that Americans aren't really looking at the possible collateral damage that could have occurred, you know, on the military base in China. And if that occurred, you know, on American soil or at Hanscom Air Force Base or at Logan Airport, Americans would be screaming. And I just don't understand why we can't just apologize and get this over with.
Well, Evan Feigenbaum, why can't we just apologize and get this over with?
Well, let me first go back to the earlier caller and just say that the notion of strategic competition does not in any sense require parity. Parity is not required to cause enormous damage and potential problems within the strategic environment.
Because let's get it straight. They've only got about 17 intercontinental ballistic missiles, haven't they?
Well, that's right. But I'm not even just talking about strategic missiles here. There is a possibility of China has an influence on the Korean Peninsula. China's actions within the region obviously influence the sense of security and stability of our allies and friends within the region. Moreover, there's a possibility of leakage of material for weapons of mass destruction. And China has come increasingly over the last 20 years to play an important role in shaping international regimes. And that is something very much to be encouraged and among the most welcome trends in China's international behavior. But it shows clearly that as China has become increasingly integrated into the fabric of the international strategic environment and has come to occupy an important seat at the table, it shows that parity, I take issue with the premise that parity is required.
Okay,
it's not required.
That's the answer to Steve. But what about Ed's point? I mean, if a Chinese spy plane was caught 60 miles off the U.S. coast, crashed with an American fighter and landed at Logan Airport, I mean, there would be outrage, and America wouldn't just quickly hand back the crew and the plane.
Well, but the issue of the apology also, I think, touches the question of the rule of law. Because China issued its call for an apology before any of the facts on this case were out. And so the Chinese government often talks about the need to respect the rule of law, international rule of law, that the United States has a kind of Cold War mentality that isn't embedded in law. But in fact, the Chinese government called for an apology in this case before it allowed the United States government and has still not allowed the United States government to fully establish the facts of what happened in this case. So I think it's premature both to call for the apology and to make those kinds of comparisons.
Ed, thanks very much for your point. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Another Mark joins us now. Hello, Mark.
I'm amazed that we haven't discussed the fact that China has over a million people in forced labor, as documented by Harry Wu, an activist, a Chinese activist. How can we ignore the fact that we in this country have standards, we have labor standards and standards of human rights? How can we totally ignore that fact and say, yes, we'll trade with China at any cost? What I'd like to suggest is that we don't trade with any nation that doesn't have parity with regard to human rights and environmental standards, that's what we export.
Well, let's put that to Robert Capp, Mark, president of the U.S.-China Business Council. Robert Capp, I mean, there was this annual review, most favored nation trading status, and now China has, as I understand it, got to that permanently. Do you have any problem with that?
Judy, let me try to take the questioner's comment on more directly, if you don't mind, because it's an important theme. The first thing is, you go and live in China for a while. I don't mean for a minute.
Actually, I have lived in China.
Fine. Well, then the whole idea of I would have hoped you would feel that the whole idea that a wealthy and developed country like the United States would say to a country like China, until your environmental protections are at the level that we expect in the United States, leaving aside, you know, the fact that ours are imperfect, we're not going to trade with you, when in fact it is the raising of income and living standards and economic development, which is the only hope that the Chinese have, or any developing country has, of reaching the point of improved environmental protection.
Well,
just
maybe
strikes
it's
me
a
as
matter
profoundly
of
counterproductive. On the matter of the gulag, no one is suggesting, I just disagree with your notion that trade with China is somehow the acquiescence in or promotion of the iniquities of the Chinese system. You and I, in our lifetimes, are not going to see the Chinese judicial system approach the levels that both of us think it should reach.
We're making progress
when China integrates itself more fully into systems of international obligations, economic and otherwise, Mark, and that's happening.
Mark, can I ask you where would you actually draw the line in the sand? I mean, America does, most Western countries do business with all kinds of dubious, shady, and perhaps not wholly pleasant regimes. It's called globalization, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I have some problems with globalization that doesn't have standards of parity for environmental and human rights. And I think that what we do, you know, we've made China great. We've made China. We are such an enormous market for Chinese products, and I realize we're economically intertwined. But what I suggest is that we go slow. They get most favored nation trading status when they're showing some effort to reach parity with regard to human rights and environment, and then we trade with nations in Asia that are working, that are cooperative, like Taiwan, like you know, when Thailand, other places that are basically saying, you know, if they work in the direction of human rights and in the direction of environmental parity, you know, standards, that's when we engage them.
We engage because
they benefit the corporation. That's not a good enough reason.
Mark, I think we'll have to leave it there because I think that's an argument that's been raging in Congress for about 20...
We engaged with Taiwan big time militarily and commercially for 50 years before the human rights situation improved.
Let's go to Gary now. 800, by the way, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Same theme, doing business with China. Gary, hello, what's your point?
Just like to remind the last guy, before I get into my point, that the last president who ran on his international relations on human rights is, I don't think that people consider that President Carter had the greatest international relations overall theme. But at any rate, a couple of callers ago inspired me. I was a senior executive for with a small company, 20, 30 million a year was our revenue number. And we got to where we were doing about a million a year with China. You know, when you're doing business with China, they're going to get your biggest discounts. Everybody's over there in high tech. Everybody's convinced that it's a huge, big market, that they're going to make a lot of money. And one thing I do agree with the gentleman in, you know, actually getting any margin dollars out of Chinese deals is a challenge. But, you know, not to say that we shouldn't do business there. I mean, fair is fair.
Have you had your fingers burnt?
No, because, you know, when you're a small company and you're doing business in China, it's letter of credit business. That means you don't ship anything until they have the money in the bank and you're guaranteed to get paid. So, you know, it's just the way it is.
What do you think about what's going on in Hainan at the moment, Gary?
Oh, I think that we have every right in the world to do what we need to do a reasonable distance away from their coast. I think that Russian vessels are off of our coast right now listening to everything we do. It's just the way business is done. And perhaps the president was a little tiny bit heavy-handed at the front end of this thing. But, you know, we have no reason. I mean, they're going to give our guys back. They're not going to do anything. It's a civilized country. But we have to be very, very careful not to go in there with a bowed head.
Gary, thanks very much for your point. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's bring Bob into the conversation. Bob, what do you think about what's going on?
Well, I'm very dissatisfied with the fact that the plane was operating in international waters, and essentially they took 24 prisoners. But I want to expand on some of my thoughts about China in general. The fact that they continue to build a nuclear arsenal, the fact that they've stolen United States technology, the fact that they've made overt threats against the United States regarding the use of nuclear weapons, and they continue to supply rogue nations with nuclear technology, advanced weapon systems, and I just do not see how China can be judged as anything but an adversary not worthy of one single American investment dollar.
Bob, thanks very much for that. Let's put that to Evan Feigenbaum. Is that the sort of mindset of the Bush administration, that you heard the Clinton administration saying the whole policy should be engagement? The Bush administration, the policy should be more wary.
Well, engagement is not a policy. Engagement is a framework for thinking about how you implement policies. And I think there are some differences between at least the stated emphasis of the Bush administration and what came before. Bob Capp, I think, highlighted an important point when he talked about their focus on American alliances within the region. The reality, though, is that there are two pillars to stability in the Asia-Pacific, and also two pillars to American policy. First and foremost, and above all, is a strong network of American alliances in the region, with Japan, with South Korea, with Australia, with Thailand, and with the Philippines. But second, I fail to see how any argument that suggests that the United States would be in a confrontational, adversarial relationship, obstructing each other at every turn, would serve the interests of our allies in the region, much less our own. If I could just make one point about the nuclear arsenal. China has a small but growing nuclear arsenal, and it is an issue that we are watching in this country carefully. But it is right now, the way it is structured, because it is small, it is largely not a very robust deterrent. And so we should expect changes in that.
And can I just ask you very briefly, from what you heard from Beijing, do you believe this is going to be resolved very quickly, that both Bush and Beijing now have seen the potential for damage and say, we've got to settle this thing?
I think I'm fairly confident that it will be resolved in short order.
Evan Feigenbaum, thank you very much for joining us. Evan Feigenbaum, Executive Director, Asia Pacific Security Initiative at the Kennedy School at Harvard University. Thank you too to Robert Capp, President of the U.S. China Business Council in Washington, D.C. We were also joined from Beijing by the Beijing Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor, Bob Marquin. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection on NPR.
This is WBUR.